What I want to talk about today is ways that we can address some of the crises that are happening in Central America and Southern Hemisphere countries in particular that are driving people, you know, that are pushing people to leave rural areas and even leave the big cities and to head either to the cities or to North America, or in the case of Africa, to Europe. Yesterday afternoon, we talked about some of the major push factors that drive migrations of peoples, and the list that we came up with included war, famine, things like Hurricane Mitch, lack of land, lack of opportunity for work, lack of health care, lack of opportunity for education. Those are probably the main ones. I don't know if there's any others that I left out here. I'm sure I have. But or just a climate of terror, you know, because of death squads and a lack of confidence in a government. I mean, all of those things can be push factors. Anyway, when we traveled, my wife Gracie and I, we traveled through Central America. We were basically looking for a place to plug in somewhere. We didn't know where and how exactly we were going to work. We actually, I mentioned yesterday that we had a job working with Mennonite Central Committee as refugee monitors, or border monitors, and we were going to be living on the border. But we had a Guatemalan co-worker. You know, our job was to be like human shields, sort of accompanying refugees that were fleeing from El Salvador into Honduras, and then accompanying them up with the help of the United Nations up into the refugee camps. But we had a Guatemalan woman, Indian woman, who was our co-worker. And when we arrived at our site, that we were supposed to meet a Guatemalan doctor, and he was missing. And 2 days later, his body was found, and he'd been murdered by the Honduran army. So that led all the people that we were working with to say, well, there's no way that our friend Catalina should work with us. So we didn't know what we were going to do, because we were a threesome. And that's right, it was two or three days after that when we were deciding whether to break up with Catalina and take the job or to look for another alternative, that we ran into this man named Elias Sanchez, who ran a development program, a Honduran development agency, that was dedicated to increasing production. And he's the guy who convinced us to work in agriculture. He said, you know, if you want to help our country, you have to help us. If you want to work improving health, and if you want to work helping us address the root causes of poverty in our country, we need you to help us increase production. And of course, we had no background in agriculture, and we protested and said, well, how could we possibly be of any use teaching farming? You know, we don't know anything about farming. And he's the one that drove us out to meet Don Fernando, who became our co-worker. He was a third-grade educated 53-year-old peasant who had turned a piece of just horrible rocky clay soil that wouldn't produce anything into just this fertile, about a 2.5-acre plot that he was able to completely subsist off of. And so anyway, Fernando agreed to work with us. Elias drove, we bought all the picks and shovels and all the things we needed, and he decided that Minas de Oro was the best place for us to go, which is out in the center of Honduras. He drove us out there, helped us helped us rent this abandoned farm, and then we had a huge argument with him. And it turned out that Elias is sort of known for having the greatest ideas but being impossible to work with, and we discovered that day. So basically, he got us our residency, got us set up, got us oriented in terms of the ideas, found us Fernando, and then we were on our own. And then our relationship actually improved, and he was a great resource person for us throughout the 6 years we were there. Elias's idea was that peasants are oftentimes, they say yes to anyone who's an educated professional, but you know, there's a difference between see and see. and peasants, you know, traditional people, they will not believe words. They will only believe what they can touch and taste and see, and you know, and it takes a long time to win their trust, because they've been engañado, they say in Spanish, kind of deceived or tricked too many times. So Elias says you have to, the first objective was to practice what we were going to preach. Those are Elias's words. You have to put in practice what you're going to teach. So we started this model farm, and this is actually our second farm. Our first farm was out, this is about a 50-minute walk from town. There's two major trails that sort of go right past it, so people, all the peasants that go off to their fields can see this, you know, our field. But our first plot was much more visible, and it was we did an incredible job with Fernando's guidance. Well, actually, he was the main guy that did it all. Farming this steep terrace hillside, putting terraces in and everything, and that's where our ministry really took off. And then after 2 years living there, a big Italian multinational lumber company came in and they deforested all the mountains around us and destroyed our watershed. And so we lost our water and everything. So we had to move and start in this farm, which is actually, you know, which turned out to be a better place, really. But this place was, it was known in the area as La Marihuana. So we were the gringos that lived in the marijuana, La Marihuana. Some old timer in the town had gone out there and on weekends a lot, and when he owned it, I guess, before. And he said, every time I go out to my farm, I feel like I've been smoking marijuana. And so that's what the name that stuck. So anyway, we were really into the ideology of downward mobility. And I say ideology because we were pretty guilt-ridden in a lot of ways. We came from a wealthy suburb of Seattle.
Ideology of what?
Of downward mobility. Okay. I mean, you know, we were ideologues of this, of the, you know, kind of trying to identify to the absolute, you know, to the point of almost killing ourselves with, you know, with the people. And that meant we lived without electricity and without running water, and we cooked over, we cooked the same food that everyone else cooked, and we tried to make tortillas, and, you know, and we didn't have horses, and we didn't have any kind of transportation. We walked or we hitchhiked. When we went to the capital, we hitchhiked on the back of cattle trucks, and, you know, and we stayed in the cheapest possible motels that were usually whorehouses, but we couldn't sleep because of all the creaky bed springs all around us. And we ate at the worst restaurants, and Gracie actually had chronic amoebic dysentery, and I got it all the time too, but she was way worse. And finally we came to the point where we realized that if we were going to really identify with the average Honduran, we would have to, you know, when you ask a typical Honduran peasant, how are you doing? And they say, oh, good, bien, bien, you know. But they don't tell you that they have amoebic dysentery and worms and lice and scabies and, you know, a horrible case of athlete's foot. And they've been living their last however many years of their life that they've lived on beans and rice and, you know, and corn tortillas are, you know, two out of those three things, and maybe all three if it's a good year, you know, and they have to work all day long out in the hot sun, and, you know, their lives are pretty difficult. So we realized we weren't going to be able to succeed at downward mobility unless we just died. But anyway, Fernando was our teacher, and, you know, our downward mobility thing, we were really idealistic. I was 23 and Gracie was 21. We started this a week after our college graduation. You know, we moved down there and just, we were so excited to be, we had a very romantic idea of life in the countryside. We grew up in the suburbs and totally romanticized farming. And so that helped us get a good start. Fernando was the guy that carried us through. Fernando totally idealized us too, because he thought we were gringos and we knew everything. And we had to convince him that we didn't know anything and that he had to teach us. He had to be our teacher, and that was a major task because of just the normal class differences and, you know, his expectations of us. So pretty soon after, we pretty much destroyed his machetes, you know, hitting them on rocks and things like that. He could see that we didn't know how to swing a machete and we didn't know how to use a hoe, and he trained us, you know, and so basically we farmed this plot of land. And
Did you give that shirt as a cradle?
Oh, yeah, that was after a trip that he took up, and we traveled around, took him around all the churches that supported us at one point. And so we took him out in the snow, snowshoeing around Crater Lake, and that's where he got that shirt. This picture is a picture of our second farm, and you can see it's a torrential downpour. And we talked yesterday about how one of the major problems in Honduras is at the farming practices of slash-and-burn farming. There's no control of erosion, and so a lot of the topsoil gets washed away. And so one of the ingenious things that Fernando had learned is this terracing system that allows you to right, you know, in one, right away, begin to protect your soil through contour drainage ditches, and then planting to the contour. And so what we did is we dug these ditches, we planted the pasture grass barriers, and made our rows to the contour, and we made compost piles just like we were, you know, like our lives depended upon it, and we composted intensively. We had earthworm, gardens or whatever. I mean, like big things that where we'd raise earthworms, we put them into the soil, and we did French intensive kind of double digging of our vegetable beds, and did. Our whole objective was to try to get maximum production from minimum and the most marginal land. And in our demonstration farms, we consciously chose some of the worst pieces of land so we could show that even the worst land could produce good crops. Of course, that was Fernando that was convinced that we could make the worst land produce good crops. We had no experience of that yet. And sure enough, the results were incredible. We had, after our first year, our bean harvest, you know, the average bean harvest in Honduras, in our area, was people would plant like 8 pounds of beans and harvest maybe 32 pounds of beans from 8 pounds of seed. For every pound of beans we planted, we harvested 100 pounds our first year. And our second year, because of the land was getting better and more, you know, with all the composting, for every pound of beans we got 200 pounds. So, I mean, we had big, beautiful bean rows of beans, and our corn was, the same thing happened with corn. And in addition, we introduced potatoes, and then we grew tomatoes and all kinds of vegetable crops. And that led to all kinds of people coming and just wanting to look at our fields and coming and kind of hanging out in front of our fence. And we'd invite them in. And we took hundreds of peasants that first year through our fields. And that led to the organization of a course, which was called Appropriate Technology for the Use and Management of Steeply Inclined Land, which is nicer sounding in Spanish than in English. And we had 12 farmers that took the class, and it involved some theory, you know, for the people that could read and write, but it was mostly just getting out in people's fields, and we would encourage people to take a small corner of their land. You know, we said, you don't want to believe in us, you know, we're gringos, and Fernando, who knows, you know, he's an outsider. Because Fernando was from a village, you know, 2 hours away, or 4 hours away. And so we want you guys to be convinced yourself, and so just try this out on a tiny corner of your land. And our objective was, we wanted to make sure they did a good job on a minimal piece of land, so that if they were too excited and over-enthusiastic, you know, they could have a failure, and then they'd burn out and wouldn't want to do it again. You know, so our objective was to get them to try it out small scale, but with lots of, you know, to do it right. And so that first year, we would just go out and basically help people dig the ditches, you know, line up where the ditches would go, the contour ditches, and then teach composting classes. And then we would be there to plant with the people. And we'd actually go around in a group, the 12 people that took the course. We'd together go and we'd plant at each of the fields, each of the demonstration plots. And then we would, every week, we'd visit from planting to harvest. And the results were that... were just incredible. I mean, we had this guy took this piece of land that was just, he'd abandoned as useless. It was just, the grass wouldn't even grow on it. The weeds hardly grew on it. He had this old dying mule that he kind of just set out to die at a pasture there. And he used these methods. And, you know, this involves digging a ditch to the contour, then planting a pasture grass barrier, or else building a rock wall barrier above the ditch. So this land he composted. And the next picture is 3 months later, the same shot. So this guy got his first year he got 150 pounds for every pound of beans he planted, you know, which was better than our first yield. And then he got up to 200 pounds by the second year too. And so about 11 out of the 12 farmers that started out all had similar results. And that led to the next year we had 65 farmers that took the class. And the third year we had over 200, and the fourth year over 500, in the fifth year, 2,000 families had received all this training. And it's a year-long training, right? And so it just became like a movement that really spread everywhere. Because the production, I mean, you know, it was all based on people's basic needs for beans and corn. And in this area, people's crops were getting so bad that I was saying yesterday that many, many people were leaving and going to the city. And many people had already sold their properties or just abandoned them and taken off. you know, some were in the United States by the time we already got there. So we came kind of right at the right moment, and most of the people really hadn't left. And so our whole objective began to be training people like Ramiro and many other people as village agriculturalists. And anyway, this a method allowed people to sink their plow in a lot deeper because the land was protected, right? And so the erosion was minimalized, and we introduced a minimum tillage technology that allowed people who didn't have oxen or people that had land that was too steep for plowing to just basically, we had a special hoe with a big 4-inch by about 12-inch deep hoe that was made just for cultivating in the rows. So people would just compost the rows and just cultivate the rows, and you know, and they could go and farm very, very steep land. And then we also introduced a cover crop that was kind of new to the area that was called terciopelo, a velvet bean. And people could plant this nitrogen-fixing crop in the midst of their fields. Like when the corn was about 3 feet high, we'd have people plant it. And then by the time the harvest was ready, you know, we'd encourage people to go in and kind of pull the corn out and leave all the stuff growing. You know, because the dry season would come, and normally their land would just get scorched and, you know, and trampled by their cows if they had them, or whatever. And this way, the whole land, all the land would be covered by these leaves, which would gradually be falling and creating this rich layer of humus underneath. You know, humus, whatever you call it. So anyway, that all this technology allowed people to go back and to reclaim land that was just exhausted. This land is all minimum tillage bean field. And people, instead of, what people normally would do is, since they'd exhausted the land closest to their homes, they'd go further and further away. Well, this allowed people to go right to their backyards and reclaim land that was so exhausted, you know, that they couldn't do anything with it. And it made their life so much easier. And it also allowed people, you know, if you're getting 200 pounds for every pound of beans, you don't need nearly as much land for beans, right? And the same thing with corn. So this allowed people to farm. Even there's more work involved in this method, right, because it's more intensive. But the production is so much greater that people were able to, with almost the same effort, you know, get 4 or 5 times their traditional harvest on you know, maybe one huge, way, way, way less land. So we figured that the average person could live off of 1 hectare, which is about 2.25 acres, I think. Is it 1.89 acres or 2.25 acres? I forget. 2.2 acres. And that was a family of, say, 9 people could subsist off of that. And that was our whole strategy. We were totally against cash crops, and we just said, hey, grow to eat. You know, grow for your food, grow for your family's needs. And then after people got into that mentality, then we'd say, hey, you know, for sure, cash crops are useful, and we'd encourage that. So I was saying yesterday that people felt very, very bad about themselves. The average man's self-esteem was so low because they were farmers and they weren't productive, you know. Well, this changed things for people. You know, we watched people really develop a sense of dignity and self-worth as their crops, you know, improved. And also I mentioned that people would attribute all the bad stuff that happened to them to God. You know, well, why are your crops bad? Well, it's la voluntad de Dios, you know, the will of God. And once people were able to start producing, you know, and like incorporating all these methods and, you know, and just finding new hope, and suddenly God was off the hook, you know. When they could see that it was erosion that was, and you know, lack of education, lack of awareness, that there were reasons for their poverty. You know, and this is the power of, say, the base community movement in Latin America, really, is, you know, teaching people social analysis, problem solving. It's a powerful way to help counter sort of the traditional theologies, you know, that have a really perverse, oppressive image of God. You know, because everything is attributed to God, but with reason and thinking and learning how to analyze, you know, then people could see that, I mean, it creates a space for hearing the gospel freshly. And that's kind of what began to happen, you know, without us really even trying. Like, we were, like, bending over backwards to not, you know, to be covert about our faith. You know, we didn't go to any church because we didn't want anyone to not come into our program because they thought we were going to use it as, you know, for some kind of religious coercion. So we didn't go to any church. We just had our own little Bible study in our home. And anyway, these people began to trust us, you know, because we visit them week after week after week, and we were totally inclusive because anyone that had, everyone wanted to improve their production. So we had the whole communities. I mean, all the men, all the women. You know, I'll have to get into Gracie's ministry with the women in a few minutes. But after a while, the whole community would show up. And at one point, we were in one of these villages, and a guy showed up. You know, the whole community would come, including like outlaws in the area. And one time, a guy showed up in this on his white pony with this big, huge ivory-handled pistol stuck in his waist. You know, and one of the guys, the Campesino guys, told me, "Hey, Roberto, you know, this guy's a dangerous guy. He's killed a number of people, and we're kind of worried about him being at our agricultural committee meeting." So I said, "Okay, well, you know, we'll see what happens, you know." So anyway, he joined the group, and we were out wandering in the cornfields, and you know, some local farmers' cornfields. And then one of the guys, we stopped and we started talking, and one of the guys said, "Hey, you know, Roberto, you know, we know that we are very materialistic people, and we know that you put God first in your work." And I said, "You know, what do you mean you guys are materialistic people?" And I said, "Oh, you know, when we meet each other, you know, all we talk about is, you know, how's the cornfield, you know, how's the milpa goes between their legs." And when I pull out my Bible, that's the reaction that I felt, you know, because most people are used to the Bible being used as a weapon to beat them into submission or to just remind them of all their bad, basically the Bible contains their sentence, you know, so that why read it? Because if you read it, you're going to find that you're damned, you know, because just like the Catholic Church says, I mean, if you're not married, you're going to go to hell. When you're living in fornication, you can't participate in the body of Christ. Can't take communion, you know, so you might as well give up. And they just figured that the Bible was, you know, was just the big support for, you know, for all the different churches, whether they were Roman Catholic or, you know, or kind of fundamentalists or Pentecostal, whatever. They figured the Bible was being rightly interpreted by all those people. So anyway, I began these Bible studies, and that was really one of my first experiences. I mean, I'd had some experience leading Bible studies, but it was a new experience for me. And it was very exciting to see the way I started reading the Gospels with people and started just learning sort of what sounded like good news to them. And this was happening, as I said, together with this kind of analysis of the problems in the community. Maybe someone could turn the light off. Let's stop back there, actually. Oops, now this isn't working again. All of this was happening at the same time we were doing this kind of social, this analysis and helping people see the root causes of their, you know, of their poverty. And all of this was happening as people were having these incredible yields, right? You know, which was just, this was the visible sign of hope, you know. If there's any sort of, if you look at the equivalent of what people needed liberation from, it was bad production, right, of corn and beans. And so here, this was liberation. You know, this was concrete. This meant food on their tables, right? This is Julian, and he was a known sort of chicken thief in the community. And he's a guy who I began to visit, and I was really trying to target the people that were the most, you know, on the edge, because, you know, I was reading all the theologians of liberation, and I was very much inspired by those models. And so even among the poor that we were there with, we were trying to focus on kind of the most wretched or whatever. And this guy we started to visit, and he had this little tiny plot that was almost pure sand. And first we started to try to help him grow vegetables intensively. And he says, "Oh, you know, I don't have any water." So we realized, boy, they needed a water project, not just for him, but for his whole neighborhood. So we got active in doing village gravity flow water systems, and we actually put in a number of gravity flow water systems, and with the help of, you know, a lot of different people, a lot of churches in the States, you know, we got bought money for the tubes, and the people would do all the work. And so anyway, Julian's neighborhood got water, but there still wasn't enough land for him to grow anything, and he needed land. And one day he came running to our farm. He says, "Roberto, I found this land. There's this land right next to my house that this guy wants to sell. And, you know, and come and see it." So I went and saw it, and And then it turned out that this man, this professor that I'd had of physics, had just written me and said, hey, I got some money. Do you have any project that this could be useful for? And Julian said, you know, it only is going to cost $400. I mean, I don't know how many lempiras that was, 800 lempiras. It's not very much money. And that was almost exactly what this physics professor had given. So I said, okay, you know, we started a rotating fund for farmers to get to buy land who didn't have land. And Julian was our first person. So he bought this land, and it was about 2 acres, and he farmed it using all of the methods that we taught. And this land had been an abandoned plot, you know, just had like a couple of horses in it or something. And he got this kind of a yield. It just blew everyone away, you know. And it created a lot of resentment, actually, because people would say, why are you helping Julian? You know, he's a chicken thief. Okay, you can go ahead and change it. So anyway, at about the same time that I was visiting the men, Gracie, my wife, was visiting the women. And this was a much more difficult job because the women were basically locked up in their houses in a lot of ways. You can move to the next slide, somebody.
Next slide,
sorry. You know, women in Central America and Mexico are oftentimes very, very oppressed. You know, to the point where in a lot of places in Honduras, the men wouldn't let them even leave hardly. I mean, they had their little areas where they could go, like the kitchen and, you know, to the stream to do washing and things like that. But there was so much suspicion that maybe their wives would cheat on them, like they were cheating on their wives, that women were, you know, were not permitted much freedom to go to a class of any kind. And so anyway, you can go to the next one. We were eventually able to play on the self-interest of the men. We said things like, well, you know, aren't you guys getting sick of beans and rice and corn tortillas for every meal? You know, wouldn't you love to try some banana bread or some soy bread or something like that? Well, let your wives go to these classes. And little by little, we developed this group of women. You can go to the next slide. Oh, that's them. Sorry. Anyway, we started a group, women's groups, and then those groups, as our program grew, you know, we got to the point where, you know, when we had 2,000 families, we'd have whole villages that would invite us to give courses. And it wasn't us at this point. We had 35 agricultural promoters and about 10 women health workers that we trained. And so we'd send these people. I mean, they would, you know, the Tierra Nueva was beginning to be organized now as a independent ministry, you know, peasant movement. And so two promoters would go and they'd spend a week in a village, and then we would join them and provide backup. And we would come and we got to the place where whole villages would show up to these classes. We'd have, you know, hundreds of people. And these would take place in a school, like the village school. And they would just be crammed to the gills with kids and dogs and chickens and people and babies. And, you know, every woman would have at least one baby at their breast and, you know, other little toddlers kind of toddling around. And, you know, we'd give these courses called How to Care for Your People. And they involved teaching people how to use soybeans. You can go to the next slide. This is soy milk, making soy milk. And then we would, you know, while I'd be out in the fields teaching the men, or the promoters would be out teaching the men how to plant soybeans, and then we'd be handing out seed. We'd come back and Gracie and all the women, they would have made all the soy bread and soy milk, and so we'd all sit down and have soy milk and soy bread, and then we'd have a Bible study, you know. And we combined these courses that included kind of social analysis, where we break up a group into five groups and have one group do, you know, analyze social problems, and another one class divisions, problems based on class divisions. Another group would have to analyze the health problems, and another one political problems, and another economic problems. And then we'd have a five-day class. We'd have each of those groups would be in charge of preparing a social drama, where they'd have to act out like the most serious problem that it was a social problem, or, you know, a political problem or whatever in their community. And then the whole group would analyze it, and then we'd break down into groups, and we'd have a text that was somehow related in some way, and each group would work on the text, and then we'd come together and talk about it. And you know, so that mornings were agriculture and health, and the afternoons and evenings were Bible studies, and then anyone that had a guitar, they'd be out there, we'd be singing songs, and these were just a really great experiences for us. Move to the next slide. But production was really everything. You know, it was the main thing that held, that gave people hope. And one of the things that we realized right away that one of the ways that people were oppressed in our area is that the local merchants, anyone that had money, they would buy people's corn in advance of the harvest. This happens all over the world. But people would buy the corn when the corn was this high. Merchants would go and they say, "Hey, you know, I'll buy all your corn for 10 cents a pound, or 5 cents a pound, and you can just give me your corn, when you harvest it." And so the people would say, "Well, I have no other choice." They'd sell their corn just to get money to buy corn from the same merchant, right? Okay, because the merchant was the only guy that had grain storage silos, and he had capital. So the people would sell everything, and then when the time to harvest their crops came, by that time the price would have already be doubled what they sold it for. And then by the time the scarcity came, they call it the junios in Central America. The junios usually June is like, see, the planting season is like May, and usually people's corn has definitely run out from the year before by May or June. So that's why they say the Junes are when you experience hunger, when you have no more corn. But the Junes would usually start in April or March, April or even earlier February. The junios would start because people's production was so low at this point. And that's when the grain store, the merchants would jack up their prices and just exploit the people so bad. And they would, and they'd be selling the people their own corn, for like six times the prices that the people sold it to the merchants for. So Tierra Nueva decided that one of the big priorities, these promoters that they organized into an association and got their legal status as a Honduran development organization, their first priority was a grain storage cooperative. And so numerous grain storage cooperatives were organized and set up. And what they do now is that when the rich people, well, for one thing, they buy, if people do need to sell any corn in advance of the harvest, they give them a good price for it. Because some people still are not weaned from that system, right? But what they do is they take all their own corn, they put it into these silos, and then when the times of scarcity come and the rich open their silos and start selling it, they'll open their silos and sell it for 25% less. And so they force all the rich merchants to lower their prices. Then as soon as the rich merchants lower their prices, they shut down their silos. And they wait until the merchants raise their prices again, then they open their silos. And this is the system that they're using to keep the prices of basic grains down in our region. And it's been very successful. These are some of the women promoters. It was much harder to get to train women promoters because they were always getting pregnant. And they would usually walk. Sometimes they'd walk 10, 15 miles. Sometimes even up to 20 miles a day. And they'd do that all the way up to their fifth or sixth month of pregnancy. We'd say, "Oh, you shouldn't do that," and they'd say, "Oh, no problem. I can do it." And there's kind of a machista attitude among a lot of the women. I saw women that would. One woman, she'd walk 25 miles to this village all the way up to the eighth month of her pregnancy. And then as soon as her baby was born, about 2 weeks after birth, she was carrying it. To go and teach in the villages. What happened after about our fourth year there, is when we started to really have success, that drew the attention of the government and also the USAID. And during this time, there was a practice of kind of a war, strategy called low-intensity conflict. And it meant something different in every Central American country. It was basically a way to use economic aid, information, propaganda, military strategy, kind of not aid, but military, what do you call it, training, to combine everything. USAID, Peace Corps, everything was combined in a large strategy to win the hearts and the minds, of the people. Because the U.S. objective in Honduras was used as like a aircraft carrier, kind of a base for the U.S.'s attempts to, fight the Salvadoran guerrillas, and support the Salvadoran military to wipe out the guerrillas in El Salvador. And then, the Contras were based in Honduras. And so the U.S. was also training the Contras, training the Honduran army, and putting pressure on the Hondurans to increase the size of their army. And so while they were doing all this, they wanted to make sure that they had, that the Honduran democracy, which was kind of a joke, but was very fragile and was somewhat of a democracy, they wanted to make sure that stayed as strong as possible. So what they did is they put all kinds of money into government programs, but they also targeted groups that were independent of the government. So they targeted us. They came in after we were already well established in about 40 villages, And they went to all the villages. They came in with 7 full-time government technicians with 7 Jeeps and all this money. And this was all USAID, Agency for International Development. Everything was funded by them and a group called Proyecto Cuenca del Rio. Oh, I don't know. It doesn't matter what the name of the project. Proyecto Integral, I think they called it. They came in and they went to all the villages where we were working. And the Honduran technicians, they started rumors that we were communists and that all of our money for our project came from Cuba. And they told the people, why do you work with those communists? Why don't you work with the Honduran government? And they offered to pay the people to leave our project. So they'd go in, and we were trying to, you know, promote this organic intensive agriculture. They went in and they said, we will pay you for every meter of contour drainage ditch you've dug. We'll give you 20 pounds of chemical fertilizer. And they basically bought off a lot of the people. I mean, a lot of the people were, if the people resisted, they said, hey, we'll give you chicken wire, you know, so you can keep your chickens all in, and we'll give you food for work to build a road to your house, out to your village. And they just upped the amount that they give people until they what they did is they had all the committees, they forced them to disorganize and reorganize under the government. And they wiped us out. I mean, they wiped us out from 2,000 families to 400. And the only reason we had the 400 families is because these were areas that were too far away for, and the government technicians didn't want to walk there. There were no roads. So, you know, at the same time, they threatened us. They tried to burn our house down several times in the middle of the night while we were sleeping. They set fire to our whole property all the way around it, you know, and it was just a horrible experience. And finally, you know, after our 6th year, we decided to leave. We were kind of burnt out, and the program was well in the hands of these promoters, and so we left, and these guys just kept on the program, and they would go. By that time, we had a motorcycle, and we traveled everywhere on a 250 Yamaha. Well, these guys had their horses and their mules, and they would just continue to go and visit all the communities. And once the Sandinistas were elected out of office, the USAID pulled out. And now the government, Department of Natural Resources, doesn't even have an office in this region anymore. So our program we've been rebuilding ever since, you know, about 10 years ago, 8 years ago when this all fell apart. And these promoters go further and further away to very remote places and visit. Their whole objective is to organize people and to train them in critical thinking and in Bible study, you know, learning how to study the scriptures. Some of these committees are, you know, are large, others are smaller. Some do all kinds of other projects, you know. Almost all of the communities have put in gravity flow water systems, you know, and we've raised the money to help them buy all the tubes and the cement and things like that, and they do all the manual work. And it's been exciting to see the progress in the community. And many, many people have been kept from having to leave the countryside and go to the city. But the main purpose of our Tierra Nueva is formation of people, of adults and you know, women and men. And that happens every 2 weeks or sometimes every month, 2 Tierra Nueva promoters will go out into these. There's still 30 villages working with Tierra Nueva in Honduras. And by the way, 3 of them are going to be coming. 3 of these promoters, the 3 main people, are going to be coming this summer. And we may it may work out for them to come up to Holden and speak, which would be great, I hope. But if not, I mean, they're going to be going all through the churches on the West Coast, if anyone's from anywhere, not the West Coast, but Western Washington, I should say. Bible study is something that is a long process. You know, the Bible is a toxic place for a lot of people, and there's people need to learn how to reread it freshly. One of the things that we did that allowed people to read in community, you know, in an ecumenical setting, because, you know, these agricultural committees were made up of Pentecostals and Catholic, traditional Catholics and liberationist Catholics and people that didn't want anything to do with any church. And so our studies were pretty much in all the communities where we go, promoters still do Bible studies. And what I discovered, a hermeneutical key that allowed us to read the Bible together. And what it is the promoters all do this. I say at the beginning of a study, or they say, we're not going to talk about what we're supposed to do. Okay? We're not going to talk about ethics, okay? Because that's what divides us. You know, we're all arguing about what we're supposed to do. You know, the Pentecostals say no drinking, smoking, dancing. You got to obey the pastor, speak in tongues, do all these things, right? The liberationist Catholics say you got to get organized and you got to fight for justice and you got to start a cooperative and you got to join the revolution or whatever. You know, the traditional Catholics say you got to commune and confess and become married and do all these things. And you know, everyone has their different sort of agenda or their different ethic, and that's what's dividing the people. So we're not going to talk about what we're supposed to do. We're going to talk about who is God according to this text and what has God done. And so the Bible study leader is sort of the referee. He says, no, that's a question about what we're supposed to do. We're not going to talk about that. You know, okay, who is God according to this text? And that methodology allowed for all kinds of unity. You know, because some traditional Catholic who went to church maybe twice a year when there was a baptism, you know, when the priest would show up, he would say some powerful things that would just kind of shock the Pentecostal person who thought he was the chosen of God for his village. And then the Pentecostals, some of them would say things that would just blow away the liberationist Catholics that were really critical of all the fundamentalists. And everyone was saying things that surprised everyone else, and so the gospel was, you know, was heard in that way. Now we have a spiritual fraternity that that is based in France, and many of the people in Honduras have become members. It involves there's a lectionary, list of daily readings, and there's about 55 of the promoters down there who have become members of this spiritual fraternity. It involves, morning, noon, and evening, or morning readings of a lectionary text and evening, and then noon readings of the Beatitudes. And we make little cards that people can carry that are plastified that have the Beatitudes on them, so they're out in their hoeing in their bean field and they can read the Beatitudes at noon. And it's just been a great way for all these people to learn how to read the scriptures and to go. The lectionary takes them, I think, all the way through the Gospels twice a year and through the Old Testament every 3 years or something. And there's always psalm readings. And it just ties them into all the members in France and Belgium, and we have a chapter of it in Washington as well. And that ties them into us, because we're all reading the same text every day, right? So this last December, I took the prior of this spiritual fraternity from France. He visited, and we went down there, and he did a retreat on praying the Psalms to the promoters. And we've continued to bring, one of our objectives is to bring trained readers of the Bible into contact with these untrained readers. And this is language from that Gerald West uses in his book, The Biblical Hermeneutics of Liberation. He talks about the huge gap between trained or educated readers of the Bible and the poor. And one of our objectives is to try to, I brought many different professors and friends down, and they've given courses, high quality education. We brought it down to the level of these peasants. And so some of these agricultural promoters down there, we'll have 35 people that will show up for a course, and they've had teachers from France and from Canada and from the U.S., all kinds of people, just great, great biblical studies. This is Daniel Bourguet, who's my thesis supervisor on our trip in December. Go to the next slide. This is a community where our spiritual fraternity took off because there was a man who came, was a truck driver in this village who was very promiscuous, and he ended up contracting AIDS, and came back to the village, to this very remote village, basically to die in his last months of just full-blown AIDS. And he was very, very kind of a cynical guy about anything religious, and one of our agricultural promoters and a member of the spiritual fraternity began to come and visit him and say, hey, would you like me to read the readings for today that I'm reading? And the guy said, no, and he just turned up his radio, the Mexican ranchero music. But as he got sicker, and as my friend kept showing love to him, the guy said, okay, well, just go ahead and read something. So he began reading, and the guy began to really enjoy it. And then the family members of the guy began to kind of listen. And every day he'd go and redo the readings, Old Testament reading, Gospel reading, a psalm. And gradually this group grew around this dying man. To include, after about a month of him going, they had 25 people, and a guitar player from one of the delegates of the Word of the Catholic Church started to show up, and so they'd sing a few songs and they'd read the text, and And their methodology was all very participatory, so they'd ask everyone in the group to comment on what they thought of the text, each verse meant before they'd move to the next verse. And this, they got to the point where they were a worshiping community, and there had been no worshiping community in this village. And when the guy died, they were just totally in peace. I mean, the guy died with this big smile on his face, you know, and he came to the place of faith. And afterwards, they didn't do their normal 9 days of mourning. You know, I mean, I think it's 9 days, the typical traditional Catholic mourning period. They said, "Why are we going to mourn? You know, we've accompanied this brother, and what are we going to do now? We can't quit doing this." So they've continued to meet every night of the week, and they meet in a different home. And I visited them. I just couldn't believe it. This is all Catholic folks, but you know, the priest shows up every 2 years, so they're not really very tied in with any traditional Catholic scene. This is the father of the guy who died of AIDS, and he was a total alcoholic, and, you know, just a hardcore drinker, and had nothing to do with faith or anything. And this is the promoter, who Don Hector, who accompanied this family. And now this whole community. I mean, every night I went and worshiped with them a number of times when I was down there in December. It's incredible. So these are some of the communities that continue to have agricultural committees. And that's going to set us up for Thursday, North America, immigrants in North America. So anyway, just to if you want to turn the lights on, I'll just summarize a few things here. There are lots of grassroots, you know, development efforts going on all over Latin America, but unfortunately, there's very, very few compared to the number of communities there are. I mean, you know, there's really nothing going on compared to the need. And there are so many efforts that are failures as well. I mean, you know, our ministry, we were so fortunate because we just ran into the right people, you know, who knew about this whole technology of intensive hillside farming and who really knew a lot about popular education. You know, we benefited from, you know, from some just great co-workers and teachers in our effort, but the need for grassroots development in Mexico and in Latin America is just so there's such a high need for it and so little of it being done, and really it's the only thing that's going to stop the exodus, you know. And right now, after Hurricane Mitch, I mean, there's just desperation. So many people are just leaving the countryside, and even with our ministry down there, I mean, many people, the young people, they don't. A lot of them, you know, they hear all the glamour and the glitter of life in the north. You know, we have areas around our community in Honduras where guys have gone up and they've sold drugs in L.A. and made enough money to come driving in with a brand new Toyota four-wheel drive pickup and enough money to buy a coffee farm. And these are just like the poorest of the poor, you know, youth that go up and sell drugs for a couple of years, and they come back. And I know whole communities that have gone north to sell drugs. And in fact, there's people that recruit them, you know, that are part of the, you know, the whole drug marketing scene, that recruit all these people and pay their, you know, pay for them to get up to Vancouver. The main place where drug, you know, the Hondurans go is Vancouver and at Los Angeles, Vancouver, BC. Almost all the heroin trafficking and cocaine trafficking in Vancouver is done by Hondurans now. And these are all peasants. You know, people like people that we've seen in these pictures who are recruited, you know, and given basically a ride. You know, they're accompanied by coyotes or polleros, they call them, you know, middlemen, smugglers that accompany them up and get them to, you know, to the city and get them. A lot of times they'll carry drugs across the border on their bodies, on their persons, and, you know, in exchange for, and then they'll have to work a while to, you know, to pay for their travel. I mean, that's the arrangements. It's almost a slave kind of system, although not nearly as bad as the Chinese, you know, that are coming over for, I don't know how much it costs to come from China. I know from Korea it's like $10,000 you pay the smuggler to get you into the United States if you're Korean. And they're just coming into Vancouver because they can come in without a visa. And then they slip across the border in Blaine. But anyway, so there's still a huge, and we're, you know, we haven't talked about pull factors yet, but I guess I'm kind of getting into that now. But the forces of, you know, the poverty and the hard work, I mean, it still involves hard work and a subsistence lifestyle is a pretty low lifestyle still. You know, we were on 2 acres you can subsist, but you don't have a lot of cash to, you know, to buy a CD player and to, you know, and the American dream is being promoted, you know, big time through all the radio stations and billboards, and you know, the multinationals are out there promoting their, you know, all the U.S. products made in the USA and products that are made in, you know, Honduran sweatshops as well. So you know, this is a positive sign, and there's many positive examples all through Central America and Mexico, but it's still a drop in the bucket. But it's the only solution. Does anyone have any questions or comments about anything?
Well, the women are all dressed so nice. You know, they have such nice silky dresses on.
The Hondurans have a nickname, and it's catracha, catrachos, which means well-dressed. You know, the poorest of the poor in Honduras will usually have something that looks fairly nice that they can slip into.
Where do they get their clothes? They
get them down in the markets. And, you know, a lot of times they're not as nice as you'd think. I mean, if you look closely, you'd see they were worn out everywhere.
Oh.
But they're pretty shiny in the pictures, you know.
To what extent were the programs that you initiated there really innovative, that you did it on the spot? To what extent did you draw for some other experiences? Like, I was thinking of the Peace Corps and their experiences.
The Peace Corps, they would invite us to come and do trainings for all their volunteers. You know, the Peace Corps wasn't really, I mean, there's all kinds of Peace Corps type people, I mean, doing everything, you know, from teaching and doing education, you know, of teachers to, you know, to doing grassroots development. But most of the Peace Corps workers work directly with the government, because that was the whole strategy of during the Reagan administration, is you wanted to, they were used basically to kind of bolster up a government that really wasn't working. So the Peace Corps wasn't a great resource. The best resources we had were groups like World Neighbors, Vecinos Mundiales, and then this Honduran man, Lia Sanchez, who had this group called Acorde. I mean, they were where we learned. And we were in contact, and we read. We had a huge library of books that lots of different friends would send us. And, you know, we were tied into ECHO. I don't know if you've heard of ECHO. It's a seed bank based out of Miami that has a newsletter that, you know, a Mennonite Central Committee, and all kinds of different, we get newsletters from everywhere. And we had this thing we organized called the Universidad del Campo, University of the Countryside, or Universidad Campesina. And we would, we set up this, all these big bent, you know, chairs and an amphitheater underneath these big mango trees. And we'd have, we'd invite all kinds of people to come in from outside, from all over Central America, to give courses on, you know, human rights and, you know, kind of pedagogy, you know, popular pedagogy and intensive hillside farming practices, you know, or how to make pesticides out of tobacco leaves and garlic and, you know, just courses on all kinds of stuff, medicinal plants. And so we had a constant, we were in touch with a lot of, our objective was to try to, we taught whatever we could, we'd learn whatever we could and teach it, but we drew on the larger community, you know, in terms of seminaries and all kinds of places. There's no way we could have done it all by ourselves. There were too many needs. You know, we'd have groups come in and train literacy people who would teach reading and writing. You know, and that's what there's a need for, actually, is development groups need to be, you know, completely kind of networking in order to meet the needs of these communities. They're just huge needs.
Is that occurring, that you see more cooperation among various groups that are going down there to help rather than competitiveness?
Oh, I see more cooperation, yeah. I mean, you know, this methodology that I've just described now has been adopted all, you know, the projects have been so successful that it's, I mean, even AID is promoting these things, except they still pay people to change, and that doesn't work. You know, but the formation, what you don't see very often is technical, you know, combination of technical and pedagogy. You know, a good pedagogy that's focused on really training people to think critically. You know, I mean, usually you have faith-based movements that are that teach critical thinking, but they don't have the agricultural technology. Or you have agricultural groups that are into agricultural technology, but they don't teach pedagogy. They don't teach people. They don't form people. You know, Elias would say you have to make a compost in high on people's heads. You know, you have to dig ditches in their brains. You know, and that was a radical thing. You know, and it still is. I mean, most groups don't do that.
Did you see Lutheran World Relief in evidence at all where you were? Or?
I didn't see that Lutheran World Relief. I didn't see Presbyterian anything either. They would usually work through sort of the most known development agency in the country. You know, they would support those agencies, which often weren't the best agencies, in my opinion. You know, they were sort of the known, kind of politically correct, the people that had marketed themselves as the best development agencies that would, everyone would visit them and give them money. And then there was all kinds of unknown groups, and some of which weren't very good, and others that were very good that were just never known. I'm not saying that the Lutherans didn't support the best groups. I don't know. I wasn't in touch with them.
Yeah, I know. It does make you realize that maybe there's other, should be looked at.
Well, one of the biggest problems in Mexico, Latin America, is the division between professionals and peasants, or, you know, professionals and workers. And a lot of the development agencies that are church-based are based, they have agronomists and these technicians and, you know, that are Salvadoran or Honduran or whatever, but many of those people don't, they're still higher, I mean, they see themselves as higher, they're a higher social class than the people. And so there's those class divisions and there are always exceptions. There are many agronomists that are totally, you know, committed to downward mobility in the best sense of the word. Because, you know, I was kind of critiquing our own downward mobility, but I still believe, you know, you need to enter into the people's lives and live as close to where they are as possible. But you have to also know what your own needs are, right? Which we learned how to do, I think. But there's a lot of the professional people that work in development agencies that they like to live in the capital cities. They don't want to live out in the countryside. And that's one of the biggest problems. They'll just travel out by Jeep, you know, and they'll take day trips. Maybe they'll spend the night, but they're not living with the people. So that's really unfortunate. I think that we have to, our denomination should be trying to support groups that are as grassroots as possible and that are located out in the places of need as much as possible.
I have heard that from various people that are missionaries going down, that they would ask for a large amount of money to live on a monthly basis, where the people down there would not even, it would take them a whole year to live on that money.
Yeah.
It was a clear division, although it would be lower than American standard, but up there where it was very high.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
In a way, we had the ideal situation because we were so young, we didn't have any kids. You know, and there's a need, in a way, that's the time to do this kind of thing. I mean, if you're an educated or whatever, a person from a, like we were, we could never live like the people did completely. And especially with kids, it's like, oh man, just so much hard, so hard to live with kids in a place where there's all these diseases and, you know, amoebic dysentery. I mean, people are losing their kids all the time. So the ideal thing, I think, for missionary, if you're going to be a North American going down there, is to go down either as a single person or, you know, without kids. And because you're so much more free. The minute you have kids, the more you have to, at least I would have to now. I couldn't live the way we lived. And we were able to live on just, we were volunteers. We didn't have any salary the whole time we were down there. We had no desire and no need for a salary. We just, you know, and our objective was actually to be completely self-reliant and to eat up, to grow everything we needed for our, we tried to do that, and then we realized we couldn't do ministry and do that. And we also realized we weren't farmers.
Mm-hmm. Have the farms that you showed us continued to be so lush?
Oh, yeah, they're even better.
So that they're not wearing out the soil that they keep putting back into it?
No, you know, we would teach, you know, crop rotation, and then these green manure crops, you know, where you would plant these beans that are nitrogen-fixing beans so that you could turn and incorporate all that into the soil. I mean, that people who have been planting now, you know, farming now for 10, 15 years, they got incredible yields. When I was back in December, all the people that we worked with down there, I mean, they were just doing very well, except for that one cooperative that when the river rose and just destroyed everything. But that was something that no drain terraces or contours, they just couldn't have done anything against that.
If you see a parallel an increase in the nutritional basis, then too.
Oh yeah, definitely. You know, people are less. I mean, they're healthier and they look better. I mean, yeah. I noticed a big difference. People who used to be didn't even have shoes. You know, now they're wearing shoes and they're doing better. They look good. You know. Just increasing basic grain production does so much, and then. But once people learn how to think critically about things and learn to experiment, mainly once they have hope, you know, when they're despairing, it's like they don't have any energy to do anything. They're just down, you know. Once they can see that their work can make a difference and, you know, they have hope, everything changes.
Mm-hmm. What's the medical care level that the government provides in that area?
They have a local little health center, mm-hmm. that has almost no medicines, you know, and they'll have they send out interns, I mean, you know, black people doing internships, is that what they call it? In, you know, their second or third year medical school or whatever, they'll send these students out, and they basically keep, they don't have, you know, doctors that have graduated doctors out in these communities. Mm-hmm.
Do they teach sanitation or basic?
The doctors are usually healthcare. Overwhelmed. The doctors are so overwhelmed with patients that are just there every day. You know, they have to deliver babies. I mean, these doctors and nurses, you know, they're doing everything. Huh. We brought all kinds of medicines down because the French, that French delegation, they took up a collection and just brought suitcases of medicines. And mm-hmm. I was amazed at the reaction of the local medical school person, and she just said, oh, you know, we don't have anything. This is just, she was so thankful. Mm-hmm. And it's not necessarily the fault of the government. I mean, the government, especially after Hurricane Mitch, is just, mm-hmm. you know, really in a bad way.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit more about the French fraternity you were talking about and how you got hooked up with that?
Yeah, the French fraternity is, it's Les Veilleurs, it's called the Watch Persons. And I got involved through the guy who I was doing my doctoral work with, who was the prior of it. He'd been a pastor for about 15 years before he became professor of Old Testament in Montpellier, and I was studying under him, and then he felt like his real call was to be a monk. And so he ended up leaving the seminary and has been joined a Cistercian monastery, and then for a year only, and then was launched off into his hermitage where he is now. He's tied to this women religious community, a Protestant community in the south of France. In France and in Switzerland, you have all the, in Germany, you have a lot of women religious communities that are Protestant, unlike here. And so he has a hermitage that's tied to their place, and then he serves as the spiritual director of this fraternity, and it's made up of lay people and pastors from many different denominations, but mainly Reformed Church of France and Lutheran Church of France. But there's Baptists and other folks too. And there's a rule that involves like a commitment to, you become a novice in the beginning where you try to live this rule, and the rule is simplicity, joy, and mercy. And it involves daily commitment to morning prayer and reading of the scriptures, meditation and contemplation of the scriptures, and then noon, a contemplative reading of the Beatitudes, you know, and kind of stopping in the middle of your day and trying to remember who you are before God, and, you know, and then evening, kind of looking over your whole day, kind of like the Ignatian, you know, examine, and then ending with, you know, with reflection on the Psalms and some scripture and prayer. And there's just a commitment to being a student of universal monastic experiences. So what that means is that every region has quarterly retreats that are day-long retreats, where they'll invite someone from some tradition, like they'll have a Russian Orthodox monk come and do something on the Jesus Prayer, you know, and then maybe the next month, next quarter, it'll be, you know, a Baptist talking about Baptist spirituality, whatever that is. No, I know the Baptists have a spirituality, but they're really ecumenical, you know. The next week would be, the next quarter might be someone doing something on icons and the use of icons for contemplative prayer, and the next time might be someone doing something on Buddhism. And does Buddhism have anything to offer in terms of, you know, and although it's mainly within the Christian tradition, so it would be like the Cistercian, you know, someone would come and do something on the Desert Fathers. You know, and we've started one here in our area. So we have quarterly retreats. We've done five now. And the first one was on the Jesus Prayer. And then another one was on approaching Jesus in Matthew's Gospel, which I did. And we just had Daniel Bourget from France. He did Praying the Psalms. And the last one was on Praying the Examine by Gary Graf-Wallner from Christ the Servant Luther. And we're looking for someone to do the next one. So anyway, the idea is to kind of be benefiting from the broader church, you know, Protestant, Catholic, and Orthodox, and having that feed your faith. And then there's this solidarity because, you know, everyone's committed to sort of pray for each other. And I really feel that. I mean, I feel like I'm sort of carried and encouraged by the prayers of all these French people. And I go every other year to the national, you know, the yearly retreat, which is a 3-day retreat in France.
So is it in French?
It's in French, yeah, the retreat's there in French.
But I mean, do they speak French, so you have to know French?
Well, to go to the yearly retreats in France, you have to know French.
All right.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, if you could start, if you wanted to be a member of it wherever you live, you know, you could, it would be in English, obviously. Mm-hmm. Actually, the ones we do are bilingual, because half of our members are Spanish speakers. Mm-hmm. So all of our retreats have been bilingual. Spanish, English.
Have any of the Honduran members gone to the French, France?
The French have gone there, but the Hondurans haven't gone to France yet. But this year, 3 Hondurans are coming here, and they're going to be joining us. And oh, also, we have daily prayer in our center. We have a daily noon prayer time, you know, where we take 15 minutes and go through this office of, what do you call it, a little liturgy. But that's for those that live in Burlington. So anyway, this has been just an ideal thing for these Hondurans, and for us, it's been a lifesaver in a lot of ways. If anyone is interested in it, I can send you information too. Just give me your address. I know there's lots of spiritual fraternities out and about, and it's just whatever you can find to encourage you, I think, is great. All right, thanks. So the next two sessions are going to be on immigrants, you know, immigrants in this country. What draws them, and what are the problems, and how can the church sort of welcome the stranger and respond, you know, to the crisis that many immigrants are facing today.